you'd start walking mine.
Thank you, KD&K listeners, for joining me on the Meet in the Middle show, where we share dialogue on complex issues with local thought leaders with differing opinions. The hope is for listeners to gain a new perspective and empower freedom of expression. I'm Dan Richardson. My email address is richardson@roth.net, and today's topic is unpacking military conflict, both personal and political. But before we begin, I want to thank all you KD&K supporters during our membership drive. We are pre-recording this on April 17th, but I bet by the time you're listening to this, we will have successfully finished that drive, and I just want to thank all of our supporters. Second, a quick announcement. This election season, CMC is striving to elevate our community civic conversations by building common ground amongst our diverse populations. To this end, CMC is hosting a special civic engagement series called Rediscovering Common Ground, with the last event being held in Glenwood Springs on May 1st, to be followed by an author tour in October with Richard Haass, based on his book, The Bill of Obligations. That book inspired this series. The event is free, but requires registration, which you can find on CMC's website. To quote from Richard Haass's book and to segue into our show, as preachers have been known to point out, speech is meant to afflict the comfortable, not just comfort the afflicted. I thought that was a good quote that spoke to the intent behind the Meet in the Middle show. So to the handful of listeners out there, thank you for being willing to listen outside your comfort zone. Now on to my show. Okay, my guest today is Isaac Moore, a.k.a. Mr. Moore from the Roaring Fork High School. Isaac has a bachelor's degree in history from Virginia Military Institute and a master's degree in education from Bloomsburg University of Pennsylvania. After graduate school, he joined the United States Marine Corps and served as an active duty infantry officer for 20 years. Isaac retired from the Marines in 2021 and began his second career as a high school social studies teacher and previously served as a volunteer assistant wrestling coach with a Basalt wrestling program. Isaac is married to Pauline Moore, who has a PhD, is a political scientist working for the RAND Corporation, speaks five languages, is the mother of their two daughters, and has great influence with Isaac. Isn't that right, Isaac?
Yeah, very much so. She's more than my better half.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your service to our country and to our community, and it's an honor to have you as my guest.
Thanks for letting me be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
So, Isaac, when we were discussing this show, you mentioned a quote to me from President Kennedy that most people are familiar with. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. So my question is, did that statement, or at least the notion behind it, influence you in becoming a Marine?
It certainly did, amongst other things. You know, and I don't know when I first heard that speech or that clip from that speech, but I do feel like it's sort of a refrain that's running in my memory as I think back to being a kid. I remember hearing it. It must have had impact on me. That influenced me, but so did my family. I had two uncles and my dad all served in the Army. And that probably more than anything else influenced my desire to serve. And it was always sort of in the back of my head throughout my childhood. And I didn't really know how that was going to pan out. I didn't have any specific goals, but I just thought it was kind of the right thing to do. And it wasn't so much the military as much as just the idea of service, being a part of something that's bigger than yourself. And those words get thrown around these days and sometimes become cliche, but I find it really true in that profession, and frankly, in the profession I'm in now, as I look at teachers and what they do on a daily basis, and counselors and clergy and you name it, just this idea of doing something that's important, not for the money, but for the importance of it all. And I find that really rewarding. I think I've always been drawn to that. And I'm also drawn to other people that are like-minded in that regard. Mm-hmm. So that quote was powerful to me, and it breaks my heart a little bit now as a high school civics teacher. And none of my students have heard of that. And I'm sure some of them are just, a little bit shy about raising their hand. Like, oh, of course I've heard of that, But I truly believe them when I pull, you know, juniors and seniors for the couple of classes that I teach that I'm lucky enough to teach at Roaring Fork. Most of them have not heard that speech. They haven't seen that video clip, and I don't know what's going on there. Some kind of shift. Maybe it's just too long ago. Maybe there's other more recent things that they have seen, but that shocked me the first time I experienced that. And it's obviously not their fault, right? Like, it's none of this is their fault. And the first time I realized that and it stuck in my craw a little bit, I pretty quickly had the realization, well, that's why we're here, right? Like, that's why we as educators are here, is to try to maybe tease out some of the things that we do think are important and put them in front of them and let them see how that applies today. And maybe they don't think that's the most important thing for them to learn anymore. Maybe they've got other stuff. Or maybe they hear that quote and that sparks their interest, like it did mine and others from my generation.
Well, that's interesting. I think maybe we'll touch on that in a little bit. What I'm hearing you say is, for you, you weren't joining the military just because it was the military, but it was that aspect of service. And maybe throughout this conversation, we can tease out sort of the difference of being in military service versus just serving your country.
Absolutely.
So in that same conversation, when you and I first talked about this, we talked about the differences between military action and military service, sort of what we were just mentioning. And you mentioned the book by John Krakauer, Where Men Win Glory, a story about Pat Tillman. I want to read an excerpt from that, the intro of that book, because you intrigued me with that. And I did as best I could to get familiar with the book before the show. But the quote is, quote, Pat Tillman was an irrepressible individualist and iconoclast. In May 2002, Tillman walked away from his $3.6 million NFL contract to enlist in the United States Army. He was deeply troubled by 9/11, and he felt a strong moral obligation to join the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. 2 years later, he died on a desolate hillside in southeastern Afghanistan, unquote. And I will clarify just for brevity's sake that he died by fratricide or friendly fire. That's an important element in the book. And both in listening to that book and reading what I could about Pat Tillman, I find it impossible to come up with any conclusion other than that he was a remarkable human being. He defied many stereotypes and perhaps personifying the complex political fabric of today, because of those, the contradiction of what I would say were the stereotypes versus who I suspect he really was. So you mentioned that book to me. What about that book speaks to you?
Well, I first read that book when I was scheduled. I think this is when I read it. My memory's getting worse and worse, but I think I read it for the first time when I was just really paying attention to Afghanistan. I deployed to Afghanistan kind of shortly after the surge, if you remember that time frame. So that was around 2011, 10 and 11. So I did as much study of Afghanistan as a country and the culture and cultures of Afghanistan, and the complexity of that place was and is still to me just absolutely mind-blowing, you know, just stark tragedy and a lot of people meddling within the country, and then these other beautiful aspects of their culture that are really hard to rectify and put next to each other. And so as I was trying to understand that complex place more and more, I read everything I could get my hands on and as much time as I could allot to it. And I think that's when I read that book. What intrigues me about Tillman is just the story of a desire for something greater. I remember reading that book, and I've since watched a documentary on him as well that I thought was pretty good. And it just expresses how he was, you know, in many people's eyes, in the prime of his life, at the top of his career, you know, playing in the NFL, and not like kind of playing. I mean, he was an exceptional football player. He was a multimillionaire, and he was seemingly in the middle of achieving all of his things, and something didn't sit right with him, and he felt a sense of emptiness. And he talks about thinking about the generation that fought in World War II and feeling like he was not doing what he's supposed to do. And so he walked away from it all, and you know, we also got to remember, you know, the guy went to college. He could have went and served as an officer. Instead, he just enlisted, whatever the fastest route was to get him in a position where he could serve. Big, strong, physically capable guy with some, you know, physical talents, and he wanted to put them to use for good. And that could be judged by some people as misguided. It could be judged by others as extremely patriotic. And I think, like you say, those two things can coexist. You know, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. And I think that's lost sometimes in the story of Pat Tillman and many others, from my generation. So I thought the book was fascinating, and the thing that really drew me to it was a guy that's willing to give up fame and fortune to be a part of something bigger than himself. I think that's important, and I'd like that to be I'd like it to be more important to the next generation, because I think we really need them.
Mm-hmm. I thought what was so interesting, and I encourage listeners to read the book, there wasn't just that action of him choosing to give up his NFL career for serving in the Army. There was all kinds of things that in his life that, again, just didn't fit the stereotype. He was really bright. He was really inquisitive. He was just an intellectually curious person. He seemed to, from what I understand, always gravitate to what's right, not what's best. He made mistakes, and then he owned up to them. And so that's what I think just really struck me. And again, a quote from the book's intro, I think, speaks to that. It's, quote, "Tillman was driven by complicated, emotionally charged, sometimes contradictory notions of duty, honor, justice, patriotism, and masculine pride," unquote. And somewhere I read that he even said, you know, he had real problems with the military action that we took after 9/11, but he still felt compelled to participate as a citizen of the United States. So do you think these complicated perceptions are the exception or the rule for most people in the military? And I know you can't speak for them all, but...
Right. Yeah, of course. And, you know, I can only speak for myself and my perspective on things. But one more note on Pat Tillman, maybe as a segue to answering that. He's also, I think one of the things that draws me to Pat Tillman in his story, he's also human and he's also flawed. And there's also elements of him that are not perfect. And I think, especially as a guy who's interested in history, I think too often people look back in time and we try to put people on pedestals as perfect individuals, you know, and that can be anybody that's in our normal U.S. history curriculum. You take a look at them and you can identify all the good that they did and all the intriguing elements, but there's surely something that they did in their past that is wrong and questionable and flawed, and maybe it was viewed as such at the time. Maybe not. Maybe it only is now as we look back on it. So there's just a humanness to Pat Tillman's story that I find appealing. And with regards to the people that serve in the military now, again, this is talk about a huge generalization, right? But I am comfortable saying that the majority of people that I know in service, most of them joined because they wanted to be the good guy or good gal fighting the bad guy, right? Like it's a good versus evil. You want it to be that simple. Somewhere in you at the start, you know it's potentially not. And then for everybody's different and their experiences are different, but war is complicated and it's messy. And getting involved in combat abroad sometimes can change your perspective. You can sometimes question the policy. And I think that's also very American and very okay. Mm-hmm. And you have to be careful while in service what you do with that questioning. But I think that's healthy. And I also think that through service during from 2001 to 2021, you also recognize that sometimes the best intentioned foreign policy in hindsight was incredibly short-sighted or harmful, or, and that's not my perspective. I mean, I think if you listen to most, you'll find that Kennedy after the Cuban or after the Bay of Pigs, he's on record as saying, "How could I have been so stupid?" Mm-hmm. You know, so good intentions at the time doesn't always mean that it's all going to work out, and it's and you're not going to call it wrong. And I think we see that if you look clearly, rather than letting politics take over.
We'll definitely get a little bit more into kind of the global and the political aspect. I'd love to ask a couple more questions about sort of the personal and from the serviceman perspective. Sort of along those lines about the complexity of it. Why do you think that Krakauer inserts masculine pride in that quote and among those other drivers that I mentioned?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, when I served in the Marine Corps, I was lucky enough to serve in the Marine Corps Infantry, which is a very intense way to live for 20 years. And all Marine Corps service is a little bit subcultish. You know, they're serving the military, and then Marines tend to be a little bit extreme and take pride in being extreme. And that's Marines of all MOSs, all military occupational specialties, all jobs. Marine Corps infantry, from my perspective, being a biased one, is a little bit over the top in that regard. It's a very intense place. It's competitive. It's health. It feels like healthy competition. You're surrounded by people who want to push themselves and then others around them to be the best version of themselves they can. Also, again, I know it sounds like a tagline, but my perspective, my experience, it's not. I mean, I saw people just absolutely dedicate their life to trying to make their junior Marines better in every facet of their life, personal, professional, physical, spiritual. And, you know, watching a 24-year-old enlisted Marine take control of 12 other lives and try to do everything that they can to improve every aspect of their lives was humbling from the day that I saw it, and is still today. I mean, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about some of those Marines in my mind right now. It's an incredible organization, and it's an intense, hot experience as long as you're in it. Mm-hmm. And I think it sticks with you when you leave the service as well.
Well, I can't help but ask, and this is part of the unpacking, and, you know, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have stereotypes throughout my life about people who have served in the military. And I think about what we hear, and we know the mainstream media has the ability to distort things, but you hear about what happened in the, hopefully I'm pronouncing it properly, the Abu Ghraib prison, and mm-hmm. things that aren't necessarily honorable. What do you say to that? That when people say, no, there are people out there in the military who are just, you know, in it for bravado, say.
Yeah. Well, I'll speak to Abu Ghraib, you know, with pleasure. Those people that did that and that were responsible for that are the worst of the worst within the military. And they, you know, they were found guilty and punished, and the book couldn't have been thrown at them hard enough from my perspective. And everybody that I know in service felt the same way when that happened. And if you can imagine knowing that you're going to go back to Iraq, I mean, I think I was home when that came out. I think I was between deployments when that came out. And, you know, there's multiple levels of, just say the word, hatred mm-hmm. from guys like me and other people who are trying our best to do the right job, which is the large majority. There's hatred towards people that do that kind of stuff. And that story is just as ugly can be. We unpacked that, figured out what happened, and did a deep dive into it so we'd know what to look out for. And you uncover things like there was people that were responsible for that having, you know, broad-reaching international strategic level impacts on American foreign policy that had no business serving in the military and shouldn't have been there in the first place. It was ugly. And the ramifications of that for guys that are getting ready to go back were pretty significant. So, yeah, just no tolerance for people in the ranks that don't share those same values. Because, again, the vast majority do. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, it's not as simple just to say, hey, there's a bad apple in every bunch. Sometimes it's worse than that. But I am proud about the military's efforts to cut that type of cancer out when they find it. Sometimes we don't find it fast enough.
Yeah. Well, and what I'm hearing you say, and you just said this, is that it's your perception that they're the exception and not the rule. And as you said earlier on, it's your opinion that most people are there with good intentions to serve the country.
Yeah, 100% the exception. I mean, the amount of that makes it no less wrong, right? And no less impactful when something like that happens and when people like that exist in the ranks. But yeah, the vast majority are nothing like that.
Well, I bring it up because I think one of my questions was asking about contradictions, and maybe it's me who feels the contradiction in that. While I have felt the desire to serve, one of the reasons why I never gave it much serious thought is because this distrust in the military decisions. And that's, to me, some of the contradiction that I wanted to explore today, that there's still the need to serve. There's still the need to protect our country, to protect others, to serve the role, whatever people see our role as. But there's this other stuff to deal with that we'll talk about afterwards.
And, yeah.
Did you feel that, or did you feel those contradictions? Or
honestly, at the time, no. You know, when I joined the Marine Corps, it was right before 9/11. And so I just made it through officer candidate school, and I was at this place called the basic school in the first week of training there when September 11th happened in 2001. And that shaped, obviously, the course of the next 20 years for me. But it wasn't as much on my mind. And it's not, you know, now looking back, it's not like there was not examples in the past that I wasn't aware of. I mean, I had two uncles who served in the Army. I have Uncle Jim, who unfortunately we lost just a couple of years ago due to complications with Agent Orange from his service in Vietnam. So the Vietnam War was, you know, was clear to me growing up as a kid, what happened there, the complexity of it, the failure of the United States to achieve its foreign policy objectives. You know, I wrestled that when I was in high school. It's like, wait, I thought we were always the force for good. You know, what happened here? And don't we always win? And of course the answer is no. I mean, I'd like to think that we're always trying to be the force for good. I truly believe that. But we did not achieve our objectives there. I was aware of that. And looking at the objectives and you know, through the benefit of hindsight, looking back at some of the foreign policy and military decisions made there, of course, I'd question that kind of stuff prior to joining. But the main driver for me to join was I wanted to serve. And, you know, there's another person that I should have mentioned the first time we talked, because I think he is just probably the one of the best examples. And his name is Travis Mannion. And for anybody that's interested and that's listening to this, you know, I won't do his story justice by telling it here, but I would ask you to just go online and look up Travis Mannion. And his quote that he's famous for saying is, "If not me, then who?" And that quote and that sentiment is extremely powerful to me as I look back at the people that I was lucky enough to serve with for 20 years. Because a lot of them joined, intended to serve 4 years to do the right thing, serve the country, and then leave. And then they couldn't leave once they met the people involved. And they felt like they had to stay to try to keep their Marines safe. And that was humbling to me. People put their lives on hold for multiple deployments again and again, put their hand in the air, you know, could have got transferred to a different unit and take a break for a few years. And they just inevitably put themselves back into the breach. And It wasn't for them. It was for the Marines that they were lucky enough to lead. And those names, frankly, will choke me up if I say them right now, but there's a lot of really impressive junior leaders out there. And when I say junior leaders, I'm talking about sergeants, corporals, young guys with their whole life ahead of them that, you know, they could have served their tour in Afghanistan or served their tour in Iraq and then said, okay, I'm going to go home now and take my GI Bill. And so many of them said, I can't leave, you know, some people will be mad at this term, but they use it. They say, I'm not going to leave the boots. It was junior Marines right out of boot camp. I'm not going to leave the boots in somebody else's hands. I'm going to take them back. Hmm. That was impressive to me then. It's impressive to me now.
So you bring up a couple questions. Would you say that is a pretty common thread that people join the service to serve their country, but they stay to serve their fellow servicemen?
Certainly some do. And what I found is in a time of war, that's more intense. And, you know, for the 20 years we were kind of, it depends on how you want to categorize it, right? Like were these between war periods, were certainly from, you know, September 11th on to the high water mark in Iraq. I think nobody would question, yes, we are a nation at war. And then, but then the next 10, 12 years in Afghanistan and still in Iraq, those are weird, nebulous years, right? That for some people didn't feel like war years, but my God, the amount of guys that, you know, we come home from Iraq in 2004 after the first deployment and we get told we're going back in 6 months, and the number of hands that went in the air to go back that had the opportunity to leave was jaw-dropping to me. Mm. And that probably slowed a little bit as the wars went on. And, you know, there's a perceived notion of it's less important for me to go back now that it's 2017. Yes, we're on schedule to go to Afghanistan, but it's not like it used to be in 2007 and 8 in Afghanistan, so somebody else can take them over. But in 2004, 5, 6, 7, back and forth between Iraq and Afghanistan, there was just a lot of really impressive junior leaders that decided to go back and do their best to keep their boys alive, and that was really impressive to me.
You also mentioned Vietnam, and I have relatives who served in Vietnam, but those who saw combat just won't talk about it, and I can try to understand that. And I'm curious, in your experience, and as you served, I'd be curious to hear if you have a perspective that might shed some light on how those who did serve in Vietnam felt about it, given maybe the contradictions that we now know in hindsight.
Yeah, I will say that I remember thinking the same thing as a kid. Uncle Jim never talks about this. I didn't see him a lot, but when we'd go, he was from North Dakota, when we'd go visit in North Dakota, I mean, he never talked about it. And he was an open, jovial, you know, just a really nice, friendly guy, you know, not afraid to talk to people. And I had that perspective as a kid. And what I know now is that because I'm on the other end of it, like suddenly I'm Uncle Jim, you know, like I'm the old guy. Like, wait, what happened? That happened really fast. You know, in certain ways in my mind, I'm still like the, you know, the 26-year-old first lieutenant, and it couldn't be farther from the truth. So I bet you now, what I know now is I bet if I could go back in time and be a 16-year-old kid in high school and ask my Uncle Jim, you know, hey, Jim, you never talk about Vietnam. Would you mind talking about it with me? I bet you money he would say, well, sure. What do you want to know? You know, I don't talk about it much because I don't want to seem like I'm self-aggrandizing, like look at the hard things I've been through. I also don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. I also don't want to disrespect people who served more than I did. And also, I saw some, you know, pretty tough stuff in combat that is not going to be pleasant for you to talk about, and I don't necessarily want to bring those memories back to the front as well. I bet you that's exactly what he'd say, and everybody's different, of course, but maybe it's me projecting a little bit because those are my sentiments now. You know, I don't like telling stories and t- talking about myself, but it's not because I'm overly scarred. It's because I don't want to make people uncomfortable with the stories. I'd rather talk about, you know, talk about my Marines that I served with all day. So if I tell you a story, it's going to be focused on them and the incredible things that they did. And then, yeah, you also, you don't want to bring things back up that you've put away. And I see that as okay. You know, it is healthy for veterans to talk about their experiences. It's best for veterans to talk about their experience with other veterans because of the ability to empathize and relate. Yeah. So fair that's enough. Something that people that transition out of service find challenging. I'm finding it no different. I'm lucky in that I've got an incredible family support network and friends that I can talk to. But we don't tend to not talk about it that much. And I think that has to do with, all those things I mentioned. Again, it's different for everybody.
I can't begin to understand what it's A, like to serve, and B, reflect on that experience after you get out of the service. I also feel compelled to challenge anyone to the extent they're able to. Just I'll repeat this quote. Speech is meant to afflict the comfortable, not just comfort the afflicted. And one of the reasons why I like the idea of this show is we clearly have so much to learn, right? About people, about our decisions, about our government, about our systems. And we do have a lot to learn from those who gave so much. And so I just encourage people, you know, as much as you can, share what you need to so that we can learn from that. But easy for me to say from outside the arena. So it is, we're just past the bottom of the hour. You're listening to the Meet in the Middle show on KDNK Community Access Radio. I'm the host, Dan Richardson, and my guest is Isaac Moore. Today's show is Unpacking Military Conflict, Both Personal and Political. Isaac, I thought we'd shift gears a little bit. You know, we talked about what drove you in deciding to join the Marine Corps and perhaps what has driven others and what it's like to be in the Marines. But there's also the global or the national aspect of our military action. And I personally hold the belief that the United States has served an incredibly valuable role as, I'll use the term unipolar power, so one power over the last, call it 80 plus years, generally maintaining a more harmonious world order compared to other alternatives. I also hold the belief that the United States has committed indefensible clandestine actions where we overthrew democratically elected regimes, among other things. And I think this might be what Krakauer is alluding to when he uses an epigraph in one of his chapters by Chris Hedges in his book, the book I mentioned earlier, Where Men Win Glory. The quote is, "War is always about betrayal, betrayal of the young by the old, of idealists by cynics, and troops by politicians." After hearing you speak, I feel like that's an oversimplification. But clearly, it's a statement made, and I think it resonates with some, and it has resonated with me in various aspects or parts, times in my life. But what are your thoughts on this comment?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, and I read that quote as well, and frankly, I don't entirely agree. And so, and I'll just say that with the you used the word oversimplification, and I think that's good. I think it's also an exaggeration. I think it's too harsh, and this is what I mean. I don't think we can say always, right? Like in the quote, he says, "War is always a betrayal." I don't believe that it's always a betrayal of politicians or by politicians towards the people that are being employed in war. I don't think it's that simple. I don't think it always is. I don't think it's always a betrayal. That said, are there times and instances and occurrences of that? Oh, absolutely. Right. And so it's weird. It's like that quote is maybe oversimplifying things, but this is a complicated situation. And so an example might be best to describe like what I've got in my head. And, you know, I could use examples from Vietnam. I could use examples from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I do believe, much like you stated up front, in the good intentions. I really believe that. And that, I'm sure there's people that are like, Isaac, open your eyes, you know. But I believe that good intentions starts it all. So, you know, when we invaded Iraq to accomplish two things, and one of them was regime change, you know, did we think that that was going to have the type of effects that it did? Did we think that that was going to, and again, this is complicated, but Al-Qaeda in Iraq, most would argue, not all, but most would argue Al-Qaeda in Iraq flourished because of the invasion. Now, you could make the argument that it was necessary and on and on. There are multiple sides to this argument. My wife, when she listens to this, she'll be like, it's pretty clear. There's one side that's correct here. And, you know, she's about 100 times smarter than I am. She might be a spy, so this radio show might be blowing her cover.
Okay.
So what I'm getting at here is good intentions by policymakers, elected representatives of our country, good intentions don't always have good effects. And a lot of times they have the polar opposite effect of what the intention is. That doesn't excuse it, certainly. You know, so if you look at Vietnam and the extent of the bombing campaign, and you just start to put those numbers out there and read them back a couple times and think about the impact on the ground to people maybe not directly involved in the conflict, it is mind-blowing that we were a part of that. And at the time, it was thought necessary to cut off the supply lines and prevent the spread of communism. Again, they're good intentions. It's complicated. We want to make it easy. I think human beings want to make it simple.
That's an important point.
But it's not. The reality is it's not. Everything from fratricide on the ground, it's like, well, how could this happen? Well, war is complicated. It's messy. Sometimes mistakes are made. And other times, there are no mistakes made and it just happens. That's a hard pill for people to swallow. My experience shows that to be true. And I think it's on a much broader scale, also true of foreign policy. Sometimes mistakes are made. And also sometimes mistakes aren't made, but there are other variables that influence the outcome of things. And it doesn't always work. So when speaking about service and foreign policy, very early in my military career, I remember thinking as war protests against the U.S. invasion of Iraq were taking place, I remember thinking that the anger by protesters, I hope, is not going to be directed at the military again, like it was in large part in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I hope it would be accurately, you know, if that's their opinion, against the policy, direct it towards the lawmakers and the elected officials that are making the decision, because the people that are in service are not. They can advise, but they're not making those decisions whether or not to employ military force. And I think that's a really important distinction, and I think it's not made enough.
I think that very notion is one of the reasons why I was drawn to this show, because I think that's a really important point. And I think there are, Pat Tillman was a good example. He did not support the notion of going into Iraq, but yet he wanted to serve. And that's admirable. And most people, myself included, didn't have the courage to, you know, do that. Do you agree with my statement introducing this question about perhaps there's two truths out there? And those vary and can change all the time, but there's the force for good. There's our role as this unipolar power, but we haven't always used that power wisely. Do you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. I think any any student of history can't, you know, is exercising a little bit of, I don't know, cognitive dissonance if they think that there's not those two truths out there. Have we done things for, I mean, in our AP US history class, we're just wrapping up the Cold War, and I mentioned this to you before the show, but, you know, expressing the things that the United States sanctioned in Guatemala, the United States tried to sanction in Cuba and elsewhere. You know, you see these really sharp juniors in high school once as they're learning about it, you know, that you get the cocked eyebrow. It's like, oh my God, we really did. Doesn't that go against every? Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. It absolutely does run counter to most people's explanation of what the American idealism or, you know, American foreign policy should be and what the ideas of America and, you know, what we should stand for. Toppling a democratically elected leader is pretty egregious. And when you're talking about a democracy that, you know, we tend to think as Americans is, you know, often not functioning great, but it's still a democracy, and it's something that we should be proud of. And to go topple one in the name of the spread of communism, that's a pretty hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. It is. And, maybe I'll wait on that comment. So maybe wearing your social studies teacher hat, I've done a show on the Israel and Hamas conflict and actually, on Russia as well. Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And I'm curious, what do you think America's role should be? Maybe not specifically in those conflicts, but do you think that we are and or should be this unipolar power?
Oh, man, that is a tough question, Dan. That's a tough one. So I think I'll start with the softball part of that question. Unipolar, I think we fight better internationally. And when I say fight, I mean the diplomatic fight as well as the military force fight. We fight better with allies when more people internationally are in agreement on some basic tenets. It's obviously more powerful. And I know that probably seems like an obvious statement, but if you look at foreign policy in the past 100 years, there's plenty of times where we went it alone, and rarely did we achieve the effects that we wanted. So I forget who made the quote, but about fighting with allies, you know, so I don't want to butcher that quote. But the bottom line is when we have more people that are like-minded speaking with the same voice, that's powerful. I think that the United States should pursue being a leader, in conflicts and in resolutions. And I think that, we have the ability to do that. We can do that well. I think it's more complicated to decide what that leadership role means. You mentioned the conflict, the ongoing and extremely complex. I can't think of another more complicated, more complex issue today than what's going on between Israel and Hamas and that part of the world. It's extremely complicated. It's extremely polarizing. It's in the political sphere, having obviously ramifications in our country and in countries around the world. And I think, again, when people try to make it really simple, this side's right, that side's wrong, clearly, I think that's extremely dangerous. And I'd like to believe that most people know that. I'm getting more and more concerned as I watch how that's reverberating in the political sphere in our country. So my point with bringing that conflict up is, how does the United States lead in that conflict? There are people that say it's not our war. We shouldn't have anything to do with it. There are people that say we should cut off money and funding and military power to Israel. And there are people that say we need to go all in 100% support of Israel. I think it's really challenging to figure out what the right move is there. And I certainly am not going to pretend to have the answer. But maybe the answer is, let's not make it overly simple, and let's not try to put it in a nice, simple, clean box and then make a decision to support one side vice the other. I think that's really unhealthy, and I think the world knows that. And going back to my original point about fighting with allies and diplomatically fighting with allies as well, it's really important for us to try to get on the same sheet of music as other powers in the world on this matter. And it's really hard to do, and it's getting worse.
Well, yeah, few can argue with the idea that more partners will increase our influence and hopefully our positive effect. I think a question I often take, or I've taken a few times, the Aspen Institute's Great Decisions course, where we talk about policy, foreign policy issues. And one of the questions posed in that class was, okay, if the United States chose or was deposed as the global leader, who should fill that vacuum? And I really struggled to answer that question. And I can give you a long list of things that I'm disappointed with how we've handled as a country. But I can't find another country out there who I would prefer to have in that role. And that's where I think it gets tough. And I'm sure there's plenty of listeners out there, you know, calling my bluff and saying that's BS, Dan. But I think that's where that dichotomy is. And it's sort of like an election. Unfortunately, most of the time we're talking about two people, and you may not like either of them really well, but the reality of it is one of them is probably going to get elected. And that's just the notion. You have to choose the lesser of two evils, and that's a terrible phrase, but I think that's the dichotomy. And what we concluded, my guest and I, with the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, or Hamas conflict, was we have to be able to hold more than one truth, that these two perspectives really exist and there's truth in both of them. And as long as we're willing to do that, chances are we're going to understand the circumstances and make better decisions. And it's not about this side is right and that side's wrong. So I'll get off my soapbox and keep going with the questions. While stationed in Iraq, Pat Tillman, for whom the book was written about, wrote in his journal, "My hope is that decisions are being made with the same good faith that Kevin, Pat's brother, and I aim to display. I hope this war is about more than oil, money, and power. I doubt that it is." And I think this was some of Pat's internal contradictions about the war and his role. But so kind of going on the theme we were just on, first, do you agree that not all of our military actions are grounded in self-defense or would meet our stated requirements for war, let alone the just war standards? I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm,
but
I am.
And so we've talked about, we might not, neither one of us agree with all the actions, but do you agree that some actions are not in self-defense and that there's some other motive?
Of course.
Yeah.
I think we'd be kidding ourselves if we said that. Now, the problem is how loosely you can tie that to self-defense, right? Like, we did a lot of things during the Cold War in the name of containment that were, I mean, preemptive. So how is it in defense if it's preemptive? Well, it's to stop the spread of communism, and clearly it's heading that way. So it's a slippery slope, but the record shows that we have not always acted exclusively in self-defense. The record also, I think, shows that at the times when we do, and you have this righteousness behind the cause, it's when the United States has been at least most effective on the implementation of foreign policy. And I think we learned a lot of lessons out of Vietnam, not just politically and militarily, but I think as a society. You know, I could get on my soapbox about, you know, being thanked for service and things like that, coming off the airplane and thinking back to how my uncles got off the airplane. You know, my dad also served in the Army in the late 60s. And fortunately for, you know, potentially me and him, he served in Germany during that time. But his hand was in the air as well, just like everybody else, or just like him and his other brothers. They had a different reception when they came home. And I think that the nation has, if you could think of that as a pendulum, I think the pendulum has swung really far in that other direction, which sometimes is good and healthy, and other times maybe not. And that's, you know, that's probably a topic for another show. But when I hear words like thanks for your service, I can't I can't help but think of my mom, who was a teacher for years, and you know, she was serving too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Dan, you and your show, it's, I don't know how much you make financially from doing this, but I bet it's not millions and millions of dollars, right? Yeah. So there's connections to service in all different types of lines of work. You know, you with what you're doing with the show to try to raise awareness about the importance of civil discourse of complex topics, service in the church, service in the community, service in education. There's all different ways to serve. And anyways, I think that I think our country learned a lot about the Vietnam War, and we tried to implement, or following the Vietnam War, we tried to implement that, like, hey, we're not going to get involved militarily without clearly defined military objectives before we use military force. I think we legitimately tried to do that, and it's not always easy. Mm-hmm. So I think that through good intentions and clearly defined military objectives, maybe they weren't the right ones in some of the past 20 years, but those were complex times. You know, it seems like the nation's behind it after an attack on our country, going to do something about it. We know where the person that planned that attack is, and we have to go in there, and Taliban, give him up. You're either with us or against us type of attitude. And that led to a lot of things, all of which were good intentions, but they didn't all work in our favor.
Just a quick thought. Was politics talked about much when you were in the service? And maybe the drivers of the war, or was it just about, no, we're here to serve, so we don't care about?
Yeah, I think, interestingly, when I it was not talked about much. Politics were really considered kind of faux pas for you to discuss as a junior officer. You know, my experience is like, hey, we're not talking about that much, because we all understand we serve at the pleasure of the president. We serve the Constitution and the officers appointed above us, and we will follow and uphold the Constitution and all of these things. And understanding that, there's not really a place for where it's appropriate to talk politics too much. Talking politics and military decisions and foreign policy decisions are, you know, kind of two separate things. As I got older in the Marine Corps, it was talked about more, but there was always this understanding, like, we're not going to get an argument here about which political party is more detrimental to our country right now, because everybody in the room might not feel the same way. And if the person that is on a soapbox about a specific politician or political party is a higher ranking officer, that puts the junior ranking officer or junior enlisted in a pickle.
Right.
You know, like, you're going to sit here and listen to it. You're going to say something about it. So there's just some understandings about where those conversations stop. But when it does, you know, there's some lines that cross as well. There's some times where you cross those lines as well to discuss what might happen. What if this person is elected, what might be the repercussions for foreign policy in this part of the world? And that was dealt with a lot in the last maybe 4 years of my service to the Corps.
We just have a few minutes left. I told you it'd go fast, and it is, at least for me. I read a quote in Richard Haass's book from George W. Bush. And it goes like this: civility is not a tactic or a sentiment. It is the determined choice of trust over cynicism, of community over chaos. And that spoke to me. And so from my small window into your life, Isaac, in preparing for this show, I suspect that you're a lot like Pat Tillman, in that you can do just about anything you set your mind to. So if I'm right, and kind of regardless if I am, what drove the second career into high school civics?
Okay, well, first let me push back on the I'm like Pat Tillman thing. I would say I'm absolutely like Pat Tillman, and that I'm flawed. You know, I've got all kinds of stuff that I could do better and work on. I'll say that. I can't think of a physical competition that I could beat Pat Tillman in.
Remember, I said because you both can do whatever you set your mind to.
Yeah, fair enough. So I will... I'll answer the second and probably more important part of the question, I think, pretty succinctly. The reason I decided to become a teacher is to continue to serve. And that desire was fueled by my mom and dad. My dad served in the military, and he served as a borough manager and a mayor, and, you know, he served his community. And I really respected that. I still respect it a great deal. And my mom served as a teacher. My brother is also a Marine officer, and he's a couple years older than I am. It's the intent to continue to serve and to give back in some small way, and I hope I can do that through education. I'm really impressed with the next generation, and I just want to try to do my part.
Well, you sure have impressed my son. He really enjoys every conversation he has with you, and I'm sure he speaks for many other students as well. So thank you. And along these lines, you know, we talk about meeting in the middle. I tell people you don't have to stay there, but if, as long as you visit every once in a while, it's a good thing. So I want to end with a quote by a British economist, John Maynard Keynes, who people may have heard of. When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And it's just this notion of, as we learn more, hopefully we learn to be flexible in our thinking. So I want to thank you, Isaac Moore, a.k.a. Mr. Moore, for joining me today. It was an honor. Today's show was Unpacking Military Conflict, both personal and political. I'm Dan Richardson. My email address, if you want to email me comments or questions or rants, is richardson@roff.net. Thank you for listening to KD&K and the Meet in the Middle show, and we'll be back in a month. So thanks for listening. And before we close the show, I just want to remind folks that CMC is hosting a special civic engagement series called Rediscovering Common Ground, with the last event being held in Glenwood Springs on May 1st, to be followed by an author tour in October with Richard Haass, based on his book, The Bill of Obligations, that inspired this series. The event is free, but requires registration, which you can find on CMC's website. Thanks for joining us on KD&K and Meet in the Middle show. It was 700 fence posts from your place to ours. Neither one of us was old enough to drive a car. Sometimes it was raining.